I was in hospital, and various tests were being run after I had lost my sight. You know, when they put all these machines overnight and everything to check the brain activities, MRI scans, CT scans, etc., for about 9 days, and I was still not diagnosed. Went to the ophthalmologist while I was still hospitalized, still could not pick up until I was only diagnosed, I think, about 3 months later.
And at this point, you are completely blind.
Yes.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. My name is Dr. Sohail Essa, and today we have a very esteemed guest. Her name is Megan Adonis, a disability rights activist, here with us today from afar, but in studio, in spirit, to share with us her journey through her life and some of her struggles. Thank you, Megan, for joining us today. Let's give her a big round of applause. All right,
Thank
Megan.
you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. So tell us, where do you hail from? What's your background story?
So my name is Tsegofatso Megan Chauke Adonis. I hail from the great city of Gold, Gauteng, and the great city of Amapiano, to be specific, in Pretoria. I am a disability rights activist. I am a daughter of Yvonne and Norman Chauke, and I am a sister to Thabo and Zakani. Mother to Axolile and Lisakhanya, and a wife to Sikhumbuzola Zola Adonis. I am a young disabled woman. I was not born with a disability. I was born able-bodied, but later on in life incurred a disability. I've always been someone who's been optimistic about life, and through facing adversities in life, one took a knock, but started to realize that there's so much potential that one should explore. And rebuilding my confidence, after losing my sight, I then gained an interest on disability rights matters, advocacy, human rights issues, and I found my purpose and my passion, and I'm living it every single day. And one of the things I always say is that being blind has been one of God's greatest gift, because I get to live my purpose every single day. And so, yeah, for since I was 23, I've been blind. So I've had the best of both worlds, and I could not change anything at this point. And obviously now I am a member of Parliament, and an activist within the organization of the African National Congress, and a community leader, and someone who's just passionate about life and influencing the direction in which I see disability and diversity going into, and just changing the narrative in totality.
Wow. Well, that's a lot of an introduction. I expected just to find out where you're from, but thank you. Thank you for making my job easier. I appreciate that, Megan. So look, I'm sure everybody is asking themselves, well, what happened? What's the story around how you became disabled
What's a disability?
and what's the disability? So let's get straight into that. And then we can chat a little bit about life before and life after. So you were 23. What exactly happened?
So I suffered from headaches. Obviously, like any young person, I thought, this can just be, I can subside it by just taking over-the-counter medication. But after some time, I had some blackouts, went to a neurologist. Unfortunately, medical aid did not respond in time. And before I knew it, I woke up and I had lost my sight. And only after months of being hospitalized, I was diagnosed with idiopathic endocranial hypertension. And they could not necessarily find the cause of why there was pressure building around the brain. And by this time, the optic nerve damage was irreversible. And my disability would be I am living with blindness.
Thanks for sharing that, Megan. Very inspirational, and it's great that we have you in studio. So I'm Dr. Nhlanhla Vilakazi, and I am a junior ophthalmologist in training. And obviously, I'm quite familiar with, you know, the story that you just told and what happened. I just want to, obviously, to educate some of our listeners in terms of what you just explained. So we normally call it pseudo-tumor cerebri, which is IIH or idiopathic intracranial hypertension. Mm-hmm. It's called idiopathic because, you know, we don't know the cause. And the famous... One of my consultants used to say, whenever they say something is idiopathic, you know that either the doctor is an idiot or the patient is pathetic. But anyway, yeah, it's because obviously the cause is in most cases unknown, and it is tend to be seen in females most of the time, especially in the sort of childbearing age, you know, between 20. And sort of early or late 30s. And there's also weight, which is also been shown in most of the people that actually have this condition. And and some of the patients I personally treat or see will usually present. I'm actually even shocked the fact that you went straight to a neurologist. Most people come to us and obviously because of the sight issue. And, you know, whenever you go to your local clinic or whenever and you tell them about headaches, you know, everyone just thinks it's something light. They give you some Panado, Brufen, send you home. But as soon as you start losing sight, that's when most people, you know, start getting help. And so they knock on my door. Mm. And a very difficult condition to diagnose, especially if you're not, you know, in that space. It's easy to just treat it as migraines and, but, yeah, very interesting.
So, what would you say the prevalence or incidence of the...
I think it's quite rare. I mean, I don't have the values, but I've seen it so much in our sort of space.
Yeah, in the ophthalmology.
You can sort of pick it up. Mm. Mm.
So idiopathic, it means you don't know, intracranial, in the brain, hypertension. So it's like increase of pressure, let's say.
In the brain.
So there's in the brain, there's like cerebrospinal fluid, right? So there's all that fluid that the brain basically sort of floats in. So what happens is that the extra pressure will go and so almost seep into that optic disc and optic by the optic nerve, and you get like papilloedema. Yeah. And you can get like, initially it's actually like peripheral vision loss initially, and you don't notice it. You can have peripheral vision loss. Unless someone actually tests it on you, you won't even know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so then you get that peripheral vision loss. And then
is that what you had, Megan? Did you lose your peripheral vision loss for?
No, actually, I did not take note of the loss of peripheral vision. I just had, you know, your split-second blackouts while driving. And that's what led to me really just rushing for medical assistance or guidance.
Mm. Okay.
So, I mean, with most people, its presentation is different for every single person. Mm. Like we said, because it's idiopathic and because we don't actually know, is it a drainage issue? Are you overproducing CSF? You know, not draining enough, or are you producing enough? And just, you know, what's actually happening? Mm-hmm. So some of the sort of pathophysiology or the reason why you would get optic nerve damage is, like you're saying, a compressive type of optic nerve loss or retinal sort of optic nerve loss. Mm-hmm. Some people believe that maybe the blood supply gets compromised, so now the optic nerve gets damaged. And obviously, if you're having the nerve being actually compressed, you would get a different visual field fallout compared to someone who's losing a blood supply. And blood supply usually is the one, I think, from temporal to where they would start losing vision, sort of coming to the center of the vision, yeah.
And what other complications, Naseem, what other complications do you get from idiopathic intracranial hypertension?
So, I mean, like you can get the symptoms of raised intracranial pressure, right? So vomiting, nausea, headaches, right? Photophobia, the Cushing's triad, where you get like hypertension, those other kind of things, right?
Hypertension and a low heart rate, yeah.
Low heart rate, right.
So did you experience any of these other symptoms? So vomiting, apart from the headaches?
I was experiencing headaches, severe headaches, and nausea.
Mm. Yeah.
So those are the three symptoms that I really paid attention to.
So like the way we normally see it is like, let's say patients have cryptococcal meningitis. This is the way we normally see in like hospitals, right? So it's like an infection in the brain, and then the areas like in the brain produce more CSF. So the more cerebrospinal fluid, and it's so much cerebrospinal fluid that they end up creating because of the infection, that you literally have to drain the CSF every single day. I had a patient who, he was also going blind, but like we had to do like, we call it therapeutic taps. We have to go into the spine and drain a lot of fluid, like almost every single day, just to relieve the headache and to try and improve his vision. But he eventually lost his vision. Mm. That's how bad it is.
Mm. Yeah. Did you have any of those
lumbar punctures?
They do lumbar punctures on you?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And you know, they don't have anything to numb the area, and you have to keep still. So I did go through that whole entire procedure, and actually, the results when they came out, if I'm correct, they said it's supposed to be around 18 or 19 in terms of the pressure.
Yes,
and
yes.
Mine were over 36.
Oh. Mm.
So
yeah, it was definitely increased. Yeah. And you mentioned something very important about the fact that you were actually there for a very long time. I think you said something like 9 days, and that's you know, they were only able to pick it up after 9 days.
After a month, you said.
Is it a month or 9 days? I think I heard 9 days.
So I was in hospital, and various tests were being run after I had lost my sight. You know, when they put all these machines overnight and everything to check the brain activities, MRI scans, CT scans, etc., for about 9 days, and I was still not diagnosed. Went to the ophthalmologist while I was still hospitalized, still could not pick up, until I was only diagnosed, I think, about 3 months later.
And at this point, you were completely blind?
Yes.
So what options did they give you?
That's correct. Well, my neurologist at that time just said to me, there's nothing that can be done. You need to just sue the medical aid. There's nothing that can be done. Your sight is irreversible.
Sure.
Wait, why are we suing the medical aid? Just to pick up a little bit on that.
Oh, okay. So in terms of the background with the medical aid, when I had gone to the neurologist, I actually drove myself to the neurologist. So I went for my first appointment with sight. And the medical aid did not approve my admission. Mm. And I waited for about 2 to 3 months waiting for them to approve my admission, and had to go into emergency when I had lost my sight, still having waiting for approval.
Mm.
So had they approved me at the time that the neurologist had indicated that he submitted the admission, then my sight would have been saved.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Eh? Mm. Yeah, I think you can be denied.
Potentially, like, you know.
Yeah, because this is the life-threatening.
Yeah, it's a potential life-threatening condition. How did, is that case still ongoing? Can we talk about it? Or?
So I can say that I've tried to follow it up, but because of my focus, I think at the time when I wanted to follow it up the first time, my family was just not ready, and I had found out that I can actually follow it up as a case. And I think it had passed the prescribed time, which is about 3 years, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
And that was the time that I had recovered. I was mentally stable and physically stable. And I've just been since trying to see what it is that can be done. But also I've been given the back and forth runaround by the neurologist, by the medical aid. No one is taking responsibility. So obviously one becomes very frustrated already with the existing challenges that I'm faced with this new you know, having visual impairment. So, yeah, that's where it is currently.
Okay. So tell me, what was life like before this, and what's life like after? What do you think the biggest change in your life is?
I think now I'm more driven, actually. I'm more goal-orientated than when I had sight. I'm more optimistic. I think one of the things before I had lost sight, I had a more, you know, carefree kind of life. Just go with the flow. Whatever comes will come. And after I lost my sight, I found my purpose, and I had my first son, which is Lisakanya Jordan. And after that, that birth, I committed myself to really being the best version of myself. And I think I've achieved more than I would have ever achieved had I had sight, because now I'm so goal orientated. I'm so passionate. I'm so, you know, I don't even know how to explain what I've transformed into. Mm. Whatever it is that I thought I was going to aspire to be, that has completely changed to what I am now and what I aspire to be in the future as well.
Mm. Wow. So in obvious, in the ophthalmology space, we tend to sort of grade blindness. And so when you use the word blind, you know, there's partial blindness, there's complete blindness. I just want you to obviously to take our viewers through, you know, what kind of blindness do you have? Is this like no light perception when you're saying you're blind, you can't see whether it's, you know, light or dim or day or night? Or is there a bit of vision, but it's not good enough to make out, you know, any structures?
Okay.
Would you be able to?
Yeah. I've got what you'd then classify as legally blind.
Okay.
So I have light perception, but it's very, my vision is very grainy, so I cannot make out any form of details, but I can tell where there is light and where it's, you know, darker, and I can see slight movements, depending on the contrast. Yeah. Background. So my sight is, it's not sight that I can be dependent on, or I can utilize it.
Okay,
so what have the biggest challenges been since the loss of your sight?
I think the first challenge would be societal perception, and it's one of the things that one got to really appreciate, that the narrative that is put around persons with disability, it's quite a negative and false narrative that creates a debilitating environment. So you find that because of negative attitudes and debilitating infrastructure or environments, the person with an impairment becomes more debilitated. Mm. So one of the things that I find, and I've always said to people in the disability community and outside the community, is that as a disabled person, we're not disabled because of the physical elements, not because of my impairment, but it's, I am disabled because of people's attitudes. I'm disabled by the environment, and I'm disabled from accessing opportunities. So you find that already, for the fact that one is disabled, you are distant from opportunities. You find that you can, it's very difficult to find employment. Society does not seem deem you fit enough to have a household, to have a family. You find that opportunities are kept far from you as a disabled person. And I think one of the other things would be, you know, the comments that you get from your peers and just members of society that sort of have a negative perspective or narrative on what disabled people should be, should behave, and some of the attributes that they've attached to them. So negative stigmatization that is attached to people with disabilities. Those have been some of the biggest challenges that one wants to really work hard on, fighting and destigmatizing disability, changing the narrative. Because I think persons with disabilities have so much potential, but because of these elements that I indicated to, or I mentioned, we are unable to reach our full potential.
And I do see exactly what you just said. Like, people who have some disabilities, if they have the right support structure or the people around them who assume that they can do well, they succeed and they adapt very well. And there's people who have no support, and people who just like assume that they can't do a lot of things, they end up not doing a lot of things. So
I think one of the other things that, you know, people do not take into consideration is the fact that being a disabled person is very costly. And I think that has been one of the things that I've had to also adjust to. And millions of disabled people in the country and across the continent and the world have to adjust to that. The cost of living for a disabled person is very, very expensive. Technology that enables us or gives us independence is out of our reach because most of the time it's not locally manufactured. Anything that gives us as a part of an aid that enables us to be independent, it's usually seen as an accessory instead of a necessity.
So things like hearing aids, prosthetics, those kind of things. And even like retraining and rehabilitation as well.
Correct.
And what kind of advocacy work are you currently doing?
So in terms of advocacy work, I'm involved with multiple organizations. And what I do is that I consult in terms of assisting and providing guidance on disability rights advocacy, integration and implementation of policy. I also, through the different organizations that I'm part of, ensure that I lobby for representation of persons with disabilities in decision-making structures and positions. We want to see more persons with disabilities being represented, not only in local government, in politics, in the economy. It's all about how can we create more opportunities, break down barriers, remove the stigma that is around persons with disabilities, find innovative work ways to integrate and include people with disabilities. So that's what I'm busy with. I consult with various individuals, you know, even myself being now a member of parliament. That's part of the advocacy that I am working on, to ensure that persons with disability find expression and identity, you know, in legislation, in policy. And we make sure that even the policies that come out of the National Assembly, out of legislature, they need to be policies and legislations that are inclusive. And obviously, also educating those with disabilities and their communities on how to integrate themselves, social cohesion, speaking about economic and social transformation. So those are the things that I'm very passionate about. I also run a couple of drives. You know, we do, what is this called, sanitary pad distributions, because we know it's very difficult for young girls with disabilities and young and women with disabilities to gain access to these sanitary pads. Also taking into consideration that it's costly. Adult diapers, we understand that it's not a luxury, it's a necessity, it's a need. We also provide counseling. Myself, I always avail myself to be a mentor to other disabled people, to other community members, mm-hmm. and those whose families are affected by disability as well, and doing parent-to-parent community-based you know, activities and workshop, and bringing services of government and the private sector closer to our communities.
Thank you. Your story is very inspirational. And how far do you think we are to getting everything we need to help disabled people? Do you have a lot of work to be done, or do you think we already have a good system?
I think we have a lot of work to still be done. And one thing I always re-emphasize on, especially now, one that has had the opportunity to really have an appreciation of, you know, the legal frameworks that protect and enhance the lives of persons with disabilities in the country, the paper is there. Now it is our responsibility as you know, government, as private sector, as civil society, as individuals, to ensure the implementation of it. So half of the work has been done. You know, we've got the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities that has been promulgated and domesticated into the White Paper on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Now, currently, we are working on the implementation on the Disability Rights Bill. That tells us that we are progressing. We've got the Equity Act that speaks towards a percentage of persons with disabilities who must be employed, both in the private and in the public sector. You look at all of these legislations that are in place, but it all draws down to individual attitudinal barriers that persist. Mm. So we must also work on the attitudes of individuals if we really want to see real change. But I think we are a step closer, but we still have a lot of work to do. Mm. We need to unlearn some of the behavioral patterns that are, you know, within our communities. Ourselves as people with disabilities, we need to unlearn some of our behaviors and realize that there is an opportunity for us to be included and integrated into society. And therefore, it means we must be active and we must play an active role. And I think now we're seeing the economy opening up more. You've got the procurement policy that puts aside opportunity for persons with disabilities to also, you know, have an opportunity to become suppliers. We must take advantage of that. But it's also difficult when you are out of the reach of accessing this information. And so we must work harder to make sure that persons with disabilities have access to these opportunities, have access to the information, and ourselves, we change our attitudes. And so, yeah, there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. And one is a lot. that reality.
I think it's really amazing, you know, listening to you and just, you know, sort of basking in the energy. And, you know, when you think of someone who's going to be your advocate or your leader, you know, I kind of have someone like you. But I just want to know, in terms of politics, you know, advocacy and leadership, has that always been something you were interested in before you became blind? Or is this, you know, a passion that you developed after your disability?
It's a passion I developed after my disability. And this is where I realized that there was a gap for advocacy and intentional advocacy. You know, it's a great thing to have all these organizations, but we must see meaningful impact. And I believe that it can be done by individuals coming and really pushing forward a collective agenda. And so I became invested through really understanding the political landscape of South Africa and how, if one really has an appreciation and understanding of politics, of governance, of structure, how when you participate, when you're engaged, when you're well informed, how you can contribute towards making meaningful impact. And I realized that I can make an impact through my advocacy work in a nonprofit organization. But how do I amplify this work? Mm. How can I make sure that it's something that is part of leaving a legacy? How can I ensure that I'm not only impacting 100 lives, but the lives of millions are impacted and are changed for even after I have passed this life? And that's why I became interested in politics. I became very interested in really learning the history of the organization that I am part of the African National Congress and the liberation movement. And I understood that as a disability rights activist, I am fighting for the liberation and emancipation of persons with disabilities, not only in South Africa, but in the continent and the globe. And that's how I became interested in politics.
Amazing, amazing stuff.
Amazing. Yeah, I mean, I think the only question I have for you is, like, how does one get into politics? So you started off as a disability rights activist, and then I'm sure that you felt that in order to get your message out and to actually impact change, that you needed to be involved from a political standpoint. Is that how you got into it?
No, so because there was already a history of politics in my immediate family and surrounding family friends as well, and the interest was already there, but not for me to be in a leadership role. But obviously, one then invests in learning the history of an organization, and especially one that's a liberation movement. And that's where my interest came about. And I looked at the policy position of the organization. And that's where I saw that this organization itself that I am already part of sees the potential of people with disabilities. It just needs to be amplified. And that's where my interest in terms of me being actively involved in politics came about. Mm-hmm. But also I had an opportunity to be involved in more community work. And I really enjoyed that through being part of the organization. And obviously over time, then you get leadership roles, which I always say, I don't go into anything looking for an executive or leadership role. I go into it because I'm passionate about what I'm doing, and anything that comes with it is a bonus, and I embrace it, and I will make sure that I fulfill my responsibility and roles to its fullest. So that's how, you know, in terms of the politics, I got into it.
Just one last question from me.
Yes.
I know you pointed out that you're sort of partially blind. Do you ever get comrades asking you that, leadership, why is it that you can see a bit of grey there? Because they obviously don't understand that, you know, blindness is actually a scale. But do you ever get, like, people asking you, but you said you're blind, you can't see. How can you sort of make out whatever you're making out?
I get that question a lot, especially when people move around and I sort of move with them. and people always say to me, "I, you're talking." Then you get some people, you know, some comrades who will wave their hands in front of you, just
Just check.
And I say, what are you doing? And they say, you can see most probably. So I get that not only from, you know, comrades, but just from people I meet in general. And I think it's because the narrative or the perception of what a disabled person must look like, must behave like, I'm sort of challenging that completely. Exactly. The stereotype of a blind, disabled young woman, I'm challenging it completely. I mean, people will ask me, do you know what you're wearing? And I describe my outfit to the T with its colors. And I say, it does not mean because I am blind. I don't have a functional brain. I have got a fully functional brain, and I know how to alter things to meet my need or to suit my needs. And then in terms of color, I've had an advantage of sight before. So if you say something is red, I know what red looks like. If you say it's a light pink, I know what a light pink looks like. And if you describe it and say it's like candy floss pink, I know what candy floss pink looks like. So I come from a point of having, you know, that advantage in terms of seeing objects, you know, mentally and being able to visualize.
I see. So, I mean, when you mentioned that story, I was just thinking about one from my life. I used to walk to school and there was a man who had, you know, the classic black glasses, walking stick, and he had a hat there in front of him. And every day I'd walk past, and when I would walk past, he'd greet me and be like, hello. And then I'd be like, oh, yeah, no, let me help this guy out. And then one day I'm walking past, he greets me, hello. And then a black guy walks behind me and he's like, Sawubona. And then I'm like, hey, yeah, yeah, this guy's not black.
Hey,
I was like, this guy, hey, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a scam artist, yeah.
I think what we do as blind people, and I'm quite appreciative.
Could you smell I was Indian? Or...
Oh, wow.
The chilies.
Maybe perhaps
the chilies.
The tone. You know, the tone. Of
the way I'm walking. I don't.
We don't know. Maybe there's an Indian talk.
Yeah. I also have a few more questions. Tell me, with regards to like having kids and stuff, did you have your kids before you were blind or after, and how did they react to it, and what's their experience?
So I had both my children after I had gone blind. And as I said, when I gave birth to Jordan, my firstborn, my eight-year-old, it was the most painful experience when they put him in my arms, because at that point, the reality of not seeing, not having sight hit me. And that's where I made a commitment to myself to say, I do not want my son to say my mom is disabled or my mom is blind and therefore there are these limitations and she can't do anything. Mm. So I think what I've done now is that I've normalized disability in my household to a point whereby my son is an activist on his own. He's able to, you know, he goes on YouTube and he watches videos of activists with disabilities. And he tells me, do you know Leah, who is this disabled person who does this? She is so cool. And I was a casual day ambassador as well. And I went to his preschool, and ever since I went there, every year he's asking me, Mommy, are you coming to my school again with your blind friends or your disabled friends? And he goes and he tells his friends confidently that, guys, do you know my mom is blind? And he really understands that blindness is it's a perception and it's limitations that are there. And there are different ways of doing it. I mean, he dances. When he dances, he understands that mommy must feel his movements. When he wants me to color in with him, he knows how to guide me. And I think that will also just be transferred to his little brother, who's 2 years old as well. So I've never seen any of my boys. But I've seen them in spirit. I've got an image of what they look like. And I think just the way in which I live my life and the way we live our life, disability for them, it's been normalized. It's nothing that is taboo. It's nothing that creates too much barriers. It's just here and there where mommy can't do it. She does it differently.
Mm-hmm.
I like how you mentioned, like, it can be stigma with the community, right? But it can also be stigma in the disabled community people. So a disabled person can see themselves as disabled and just leave it at that, and just say, you know, they'll like embrace that disability mindset, or they can not have that mindset and they can try and be like enable themselves to do the things they need to do. And you have a big problem with mindset. Yeah.
Correct. It's all about the mind. And what type of, or how you want to portray yourself. Do you want to portray yourself as vulnerable, or do you want to be confident, independent, and understand that the limitations are there? There are limitations, but they should not be your barriers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very important take-home message. Is there any other questions you guys had for?
Just one last question. I don't know if you can still remember, but on that day when you woke up or when it happened, do you still remember your emotions, your feelings, or when they told you, when the neurologist told you that, you know, there's nothing we can do, this is basically your life, just that moment, would you like explaining how you felt?
Okay, yes. So the day that I woke up and woke up with blurred vision, I thought to myself, oh no, this means I just go to the doctor, go to the hospital, emergency room, and I'll be sorted out, you know, in no time.
Mm.
And by then, I was not panicking so much, but my husband and everyone around me, my mother, they were panicking, but I was very calm. And I thought, like any other person, you know, once you go to the hospital, they have to fix it.
Mm.
And then my doctor told me after some time, and I thought, no. Then I went to the eye institute, institution, and they did the whole eye test and everything. And, that's where I was told that there's nothing that can be done. My optic nerves are damaged to a point of not being, you know, it's irreversible.
Mm.
And I think for me, sorry.
No, it's okay.
Sorry. I think for me, it was, the reality of it, that there's nothing that can happen, there's no one who can reverse this or fix it for me. I'm going to have to be dependent on others, and I won't have my full independence anymore, or society is going to judge me, and all of these things. It hit me, and I walked out of the room. The doctor went into the reception, and my body went into a fit. So I started shaking severely, and yeah. And then I blacked out.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I can see it's a very personal and very emotional thing to talk about. I just want to know, and in terms of just your partner, how, you know, has it taken a toll in your relationship? Just in terms of your relationship, or because I actually also noticed that you actually got married quite young. So how did this now new diagnosis or new reality affect your marriage?
Because I think for a lot of people, you know, you start your relationship in the early days, it's all about fun, and we're going to, you know, do things together, and we're going to be this, you know, happy couple. And yeah, in 20, 30 years' time, yeah, he's going to get high blood pressure, and I'm going to have to give him tablets, and, you know, we may have to go to the hospital once or twice, but that's all coming in the future. Yeah. Now it's all about fun and happiness. How did that shift the dynamic in your relationship at such an early age?
I think for us, my husband took, because by then he was still my boyfriend.
Oh, okay.
He was my boyfriend at that time when I lost my sight. He took quite a strain, because he had to see me going through this transition. And at some point, I had to be hospitalized in Krugersdorp to get an LP shunt put in. And, you know, the LP shunt procedure is quite a painful one. And having, you know, a procedure that was supposed to take about 45 to 50 minutes and being in theater for about 3 hours because they were having difficulties and coming out and having gone paralyzed on one side, you know, the reality for him of, we were laughing just a few weeks or months ago, you know, living life like carefree, making all of these plans, and what the reality is right now and could be. I think he took it quite hard, but he was very consistent in his support, very consistent in, you know, encouraging me on a daily basis, supporting my family, my mother, being that pillar of strength for everyone else around me when they were falling apart. And in terms of the, you know, relationship dynamic, my husband and I had our first son after I went blind. My husband and I got married after I went blind. We had our second child, obviously, after I went blind. We started changing our goals and aspirations and dreams after I went blind. And ever since, we've been going from strength to strength because I did not let my disability alter me. I let it enhance who I was. And he has grown to love this, you know, Megan Adonis, this blind goddess, this, you know, activist, you know, this woman who is so passionate about disability. And he's learned how to do things differently. And I think our relationship is stronger than ever. And each year it goes from strength to strength. And this year, actually, my husband and I have been together for 12 years and we're still like boyfriend and girlfriend. And that's what we have committed to each other, that we're going to continue to live life to its fullest. And we're always going to be each other's best friends.
Wow. That's awesome. That's truly amazing. And I think the point that you made, even our last guest made about his disability, that he actually felt like it changed the trajectory of his life. It was a very, very harsh, difficult thing to deal with in that moment. But then to feel the sense of freedom and feel the sense of overcoming this trial, I think is what gave him perspective. And it's amazing to also hear that your partner shared in that adversity with you, and now you guys are happy and prosperous together. That's all the time that we have for this episode. I really appreciate you coming on our show and chatting. Is there any final words you have for our guests?
I think, you know, one aspect that we did not touch on is the part of, you know, I got into the space of social media influencing to change the narrative and perception around disability and to destigmatize it. And one of the things that I picked up, and I think it's quite critical and important, is that, you know, the attitudes of those in the entertainment and beauty industry is sort of, it's an attitude that is accommodative for now and not understanding the reality of a disabled person who lives with a disability on a daily or has a disability and has to live with it on a daily basis. And I've seen, you know, one being subjected to, you know, forms of emotional abuse, so one being, you know, excluded from certain opportunities within the beauty and entertainment industry because of these negative perception. And the minute a disabled person is winning, you get an able-bodied person who thinks they are not deserving of it. And as a message to your audience, one would want to say, you know what, you must start to live life on your own terms. You must understand that the sky is no longer the limit. And you must tell them that Megan Chauke Adonis, the blind goddess, is the one who reaffirms that the sky is no longer the limit. You must make it your ultimate goal to break down barriers, to destigmatize disability, and for us to ensure that this becomes not only a non-sexist, non-racial, but it must be a non-ableist society where disability is no longer a box that we have to check, but it has been normalized and integrated into societal and economical opportunities. And lastly, social cohesion is imperative in order for us to see South Africa thrive. And therefore, it means each and every single citizen must be part of it. And to young people with disabilities, to future generations to come with disabilities, you must know that you are filled with so much potential. To mothers, to fathers, to relatives of children with disabilities, harness their talent, love them, instill confidence. They are a God's gift to you. They are God's gift to us. Appreciate them and reaffirm your love to them. They deserve it. And to those who've got partners with disabilities, listen, do not limit them. Let them express themselves. Let them go out there and be the best version of themselves. Lastly, to those in the professional space, persons with disabilities are not going anywhere. We're here to stay, and you will see us in every single corner of this country. You'll see us in every single corridor of this country. We are here to stay, and we're taking our rightful place. And I always say to disabled people, stand up, stop being a passenger, be an active citizen. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. That was Megan Adana sharing her beautiful story with us. That's it from us here at Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. My name is Dr. Sohail Essa, signing off.
Dr. Vilagazi, signing out.
Dr. Naseem Sharif.
And Megan Chowker Adonis, the blind goddess, signing out.
We'll see you guys next week.